Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart. Welcome back to another episode. Happy Friday. I wanted to bring you an update on the Kavanaugh confirmation battle. His cloture vote passed 51-49, so the Senate will be voting on Saturday to confirm Judge Kavanaugh, so I'll bring you the latest on that. Also have an interview with Jake Porter, who's the Libertarian nominee for governor of Iowa. We're discussing different issues related to the campaign, as well as the whole debate debacle about Jake being left out of the different gubernatorial debates. So before we get to all that, first, a word from our sponsor.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
The cloture vote was 51-49 in favor of moving ahead for a final vote and ending debate. Obviously, the Senate rules have changed. They no longer need a 60 vote majority in order to end debate. It's just simple majority now. It was mainly along partisan lines. U.S. Senator Joe Manchin voted in favor of cloture. He's a Democrat. He was the only Democrat who voted in favor of cloture. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who's a Republican, voted against cloture. So it was still kind of up in the air what the final vote was going to look like, because somebody might vote for cloture, but that doesn't mean they're necessarily going to vote for confirmation. So Susan Collins voted in favor of the U.S. Senator from Maine, who's Republican, very moderate. Actually, probably liberals, definitely on social issues, liberal. She was kind of a big question mark as far as how she was going to approach Kavanaugh's confirmation vote. And then we hear this afternoon.
Mr. President, the Constitution does not provide guidance on how we are supposed to evaluate these competing claims. It leaves that decision up to each senator. This is not a criminal trial, and I do not believe that the claims such as these need to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Nevertheless, fairness would dictate that the claims at least should meet a threshold of more likely than not as our standard. The facts presented do not mean that Professor Ford was not sexually assaulted that night or at some other time, but they do lead me to conclude that the allegations failed to meet the more likely than not standard. Therefore, I do not believe that these charges can fairly prevent Judge Kavanaugh from serving on the court. Mr. President, we've heard a lot of charges and countercharges about Judge Kavanaugh. But as those who have known him best have attested, he has been an exemplary public servant, judge, teacher, coach, husband, and father. Despite the turbulent, bitter fights surrounding his nomination, my fervent hope is that Brett Kavanaugh will work to lessen the divisions in the Supreme Court so that we have far fewer 5-4 decisions, and so that public confidence in our judiciary and our highest court is restored. Mr. President, I will vote to confirm Judge Kavanaugh. Thank you, Mr. President.
Susan Collins' yes vote guarantees confirmation. At most, it would be 50-50, requiring a Vice President Pence to vote yes as a tiebreaker. That's not going to be the case because Joe Manchin, U.S. Senator out of West Virginia, said he's going to vote yes. He was interesting to watch. People were kind of keeping an eye on seeing what he was going to do. He's in a tough race. He's the only Democrat that's going to vote yes on this nomination. He was looking to see what Senator Collins was going to do. He waited to vote yes on cloture until after she voted yes on cloture. He didn't come out with his statement until after she made her floor speech on the U.S. Senate. 55% of West Virginians said that Judge Kavanaugh should be confirmed. I don't remember what the opposition was, but it wasn't even close. It was like 55 to 20-something percent. So there was a lot of political pressure on him to vote yes, and I think had he voted no, that definitely would have been a death knell for his re-election campaign that I think is going to struggle anyway. So it'll be interesting to see. And after he made his statement to vote yes, here's what he ran into. Now, Senator Lisa Murkowski's no vote on cloture was interesting. She, again, is a Republican from Alaska. She made the following statement as the press kind of, it wasn't a formal statement, press were just kind of going, surrounding her. And she said, "I don't have a statement right now because I did not come to a decision on this until walking into the door, into the floor this morning. I've been wrestling to really try to know what is fair and what is right, and the truth is that none of this has been fair. This hasn't been fair to the judge, but I also recognize that we need to have institutions that are viewed as fair, and if people who are victims, people who feel that there is no fairness in our system of government, particularly within our courts, we've gone down a path that is not good and right for this country. And so I've been wrestling with whether or not this was about the qualifications of a good man, or is this bigger than the nominee? And I believe we are dealing with issues right now that are bigger than the nominee. And how we can ensure that our institutions, not only the legislative branch, but our judicial branch, continue to be respected. This is what I've been wrestling with. And so I took the very, very difficult vote that I did. I believe that Brett Kavanaugh is a good man. I believe he is a good man. It may be that, in my view, he's not the right man for the court at this time. I've taken my vote here this morning. I'm going to go back to my office and write a floor statement that is more fulsome. This has truly been the most difficult evaluation decision I've ever had to make. And I've made some interesting ones in my political career, but I value and respect where my colleagues have come down from their support for the judge. I also think that we're at a place where we need to be thinking again about the credibility and the integrity of our institutions." So, this statement, it just may be that, in my view, he's not the right man for the court at this time, even though he's a good man. And it's just interesting. She's talking about the whole process not being fair, but yet her vote, frankly, is not fair. I mean, in my mind, this is not a hard decision. This really is not a hard decision. And it's not because I'm not taking the allegations seriously. I've stated that over and over and over again. I do take allegations like this seriously. But I think in this process, especially in a political environment such as this, and especially when somebody's, career is on the line, their reputation is on the line, that we give due diligence to the evidence that's presented and the evidence came back wanting. There was no corroboration. And I'm looking at this at probably the lowest standard possible of evidentiary standard, and that's I'm not looking at this as though it's a criminal case. I'm not looking for reason, you know, that has to be, you know, proven beyond a reasonable doubt, but rather, is this more likely than not? And I have to come based especially, and thank you, Senator Flake, for the extra week of the allegation made by I can't think of her name off the top of my head. The third allegation just fell apart. Deborah Ramirez, is the FBI couldn't corroborate. They weren't able to corroborate Dr. Ford's allegation either. So, you know, I think this isn't really a hard decision. If you look at his qualifications, he's supremely qualified. He has 12 years on the bench, and he's served with distinction. He's had a lot of you know, references and support. Outside of these allegations, he's been unimpeachable as far as I'm concerned. And what this has turned into is really a partisan food fight. I was really intrigued as well. Senator Ben Sasse spoke, I believe it was last night or the night before. It was after cloture was filed. I can't remember exactly when, but he took the floor. He talked about the Me Too movement. He made some interesting statements. And ones that I think have been ripped. There have been people who have ripped what he said about the judicial, about supporting a different nominee or thinking that we should have a different nominee and ripping that out of the context of everything he said. He wasn't bashing Kavanaugh by any stretch of the imagination, but he was talking about a process. And I think it was, he actually said some things I favored Judge Amy Coney Barrett. Because one of the reasons why now, I think she's the most originalist judge on the potential short list that President Trump was looking at this summer before he made his announcement. But I also thought, you know, allegations like what we saw with Brett Kavanaugh, that wouldn't have likely happened under a Barrett nomination. I mean, obviously they would probably find something else to throw at her. Just because that seems to be the way we're going lately, and that's how this is taking this par for the course. Unfortunately, with a seat like this, when it's such a key seat, and it's going to change the makeup of the court. But that's not who we nominated, and that's what Sasse said as well. But here's an excerpt from Sasse's speech.
A Supreme Court confirmation vote isn't a grand choice about whether we love our daughters or whether we trust our sons. That is not the choice before us. This is a consent decision about one person for one seat. Again, I'm not here to talk tonight about the particular vote. There's lots of lobbying going on around this body right now. I'm not here to talk about that particular vote. But I will say that I've spent more than 150 hours at this point reviewing documents and in hearings and consulting investigators and experts related to this confirmation. Moreover, I'll also say that although I've said many complimentary things about Judge Brett Kavanaugh and his distinguished record of 12 years of service on the DC Circuit Court, I will say that I urged the president back in June and early July to make a different choice before he announced this nomination. I urged him to nominate a different individual. I urged the president to nominate a woman. Part of my argument then was that the very important Me Too movement was also very new, and that this Senate is not at all well prepared to handle potential allegations of sexual harassment and assault that might have come forward. This was absent knowing a particular nominee. Let me be clear. There is some academic literature that suggests that very few allegations of sexual assault in the broader culture are fabricated, or stated conversely, the hefty majority of allegations of sexual assault in our broader culture are probably true. But in politics, in this city, a place filled with politicians who constantly believe that the end justifies the means, that situation might well have been different, I argued in June. So in the interest of cautious prudence, I urged a different path than the one that was chosen. But so what? Once the decision was made, once the president made his nomination, that meant that the work the Senate needed to do was to evaluate the specific evidence and claims about the specific individual that was on the floor before us. But we're being told now that our vote isn't about a specific individual, a specific seat, or specific evidence, but rather we're being told that the choice before us in this confirmation is a much broader choice about whether we do or don't care about women. If you turn on cable news, or if you open up social media, and I highly recommend against both of those things in times like this. For the last 2.5 weeks, I've stayed clear almost entirely of those two ugly places, and it's been good for my soul. But what you hear, if you turn on cable or if you look at social media, is pick a side. It's good versus evil. Everything is immediate. Everything is certain. There is no doubt. There is no gray. There are only tribes of Hatfields and McCoys, Israelis and Palestinians, a world of generational hatred without end.
I think Senator Sasse is making a great point. I don't know what needs to happen as we move forward. I think the Senate needs to come up with some rules to deal with allegations like this. I think it needs to be handled as much in a nonpartisan manner as possible. I believe it should be handled privately. I think there needs to be some strict rules about the privacy of the investigation, because this leaking and what's happening in the media, it's just turned it into a circus, and that's not fair for anybody. So, you know, we certainly don't want somebody with poor character to be in the position, whether it's Supreme Court or District Court or Circuit Court or some other, you know, executive branch appointment. We don't want somebody of poor character to be in those roles. But when an accusation is made, that needs to be, I think, investigated in a way that's not under the spotlight of the media, especially when it's not a founded allegation, because we don't want to see people get smeared. I think that the death threats against both families and all the crap that they've had to endure, it's just awful, awful, and it should never happen. So this should have been handled completely differently. I liked what Senator Collins had to say about how this was handled in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I thought she had some great criticisms. I thought also what she said about Senator Feinstein was a little bit laughable, but the rest was good.
Watching her, Mr. President, I could not help but feel that some people who wanted to engineer the defeat of this nomination cared little, if at all, for her well-being. Professor Ford testified that a very limited number of people had access to her letter. Yet that letter found its way into the public domain. She testified that she never gave permission for that very private letter to be released. And yet, here we are. We are in the middle of a fight that she never sought, arguing about claims that she wanted to raise confidentially. Now, one theory I've heard espoused repeatedly is that our colleague, Senator Feinstein, leaked Professor Ford's letter at the 11th hour to derail this process. I want to state this very clearly. I know Senator Dianne Feinstein extremely well, and I believe that she would never do that. I knew that to be the case before she even stated it at the hearing. She is a person of integrity, and I stand by her. I have also heard some argue that the chairman of the committee somehow treated Professor Ford unfairly. Nothing could be further from the truth. Chairman Grassley, along with his excellent staff, treated Professor Ford with compassion and respect throughout the entire process. And that is the way the senator from Iowa has conducted himself throughout a lifetime dedicated to public service. But the fact remains, Mr. President, someone leaked this letter against Professor Ford's express wishes. I suspect, regrettably, that we will never know for certain who did it. To that leaker, who I hope is listening now, let me say that what you did was unconscionable. You have taken a survivor who was not only entitled to your respect, but who also trusted you to protect her. And you have sacrificed her well-being in a misguided attempt to win whatever political crusade.
So what happens with Kavanaugh being on the court? Well, you know, we're talking about Roe v. Wade being overturned. I know Senator Collins made some statements during her speech that gave me heartburn, painted him, Kavanaugh, to be a complete centrist. And I don't think that's quite an accurate picture. I will say that he was not my top choice as a nominee. I've never said I think this he or any judge is going to be slam dunk in reversing Roe v. Wade. I think it's possible. I think we might need to get another justice on the court, because I have a feeling there's some people who aren't going to want to do it on a 5-4 basis. I think we're going to probably see more limited decisions rather than wide sweeping ones, which frankly, that would be a welcome change. I don't think the court should make huge cultural sweeping decisions like what we saw with Obergefell. I don't think we're going to see decisions like that, but I think we're going to see limited ones based on the text of the law and the text of the Constitution that I think is going to take us back in the right direction, I hope. I could be completely wrong. I'll be willing to admit that I could be completely wrong, but I've seen some read some of his decisions. I've read some commentary about his decisions from people who are in the know, like David French and others that stand behind Kavanaugh, saying that he would be a good jurist, and he has been a good jurist for the most part. Not that we're going to necessarily like every single decision that he makes, and the whole point of this is to get an originalist on the bench. Not necessarily. Here's the thing. I don't want an activist judge, whether that's a conservative activist judge or a liberal activist judge. I want somebody who's going to interpret the Constitution and make appropriate decisions. So, hopefully that'll be him. I don't think this battle's over because House Democrats, and there's still a possibility that the House Democrats could take the majority, are already promising an investigation. The New York Times reports, quote, House Democrats will open an investigation into accusations of sexual misconduct and perjury against Judge Brett M. Kavanaugh if they win control of the House in November. Representative Gerald Nadler, the New York Democrat in line to be chairman of the Judiciary Committee, said on Friday, speaking on the eve of Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation vote this weekend, Mr. Nadler said there was evidence that Senate Republicans and the FBI had overseen a whitewash investigation of the allegations and that the legitimacy of the Supreme Court was at stake. He sidestepped the issue of impeachment. It is not something we are eager to do, Mr. Nadler said in an interview, but the Senate, having failed to do its proper constitutionally mandated job of advising consent, we're going to have to do something to provide a check and balance to protect the rule of law and to protect the legitimacy of one of our most important institutions. Of course, this statement by him that the Senate failed to do its job. No, the Senate failed to do what he wanted to see them do. I fully admit the process was a circus, but that's thanks to the Democrats. That wasn't the Republicans. Chuck Grassley, who I've always respected Chuck Grassley, our senior senator out of state of Iowa, but I've come to respect him more and more over the last few weeks, since he's taken over the chairmanship of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I think he's done a fabulous job. But his his press folks sent out the summary of the Senate Judiciary Committee investigation. It said, basically, committee staff continue to work tirelessly to pursue any and all substantive leads. In the course of the continuing investigation, staff members have spoken with 35 individuals, a task that requires extensive work during nights and weekends. More than 20 committee staffers have contributed to the investigative efforts. The committee has not received any evidence that would corroborate the claims made by Dr. Ford, Ms. Ramirez, Ms. Swetnick, that was the name I was forgetting, Ms. Swetnick, or anybody else, detailing Ford allegations. In response to Dr. Ford's allegations, committee staff repeatedly requested an opportunity to interview Dr. Ford, but her lawyers repeatedly refused. Committee staff offered to fly to California or any other location to interview Dr. Ford, but as Dr. Ford explained at her hearing, she was not clear that this offer had been made. The committee thus reopened the hearing on Judge Kavanaugh's nomination. So, and basically detailing the people they spoke to, as well as the hearings that were held and the testimony that was gathered. So again, they went through and interviewed everybody that was a potential firsthand witness. And that's what the FBI did as well. I saw an executive summary sent out last night. They sought to interview 11 people. Only 10 responded, said, you know, were willing to interview firsthand people who could provide corroboration, not secondhand people who could possibly provide hearsay. That's not corroboration. That's crap evidence. So again, the conclusion is there's no corroboration of the allegations made against Judge Kavanaugh. The FBI didn't find any. The Senate investigation didn't find any. Chris Coons, Senator Chris Coons out of Delaware, a Democrat, made an interesting statement about the FBI allegations.
I do think that Judge Kavanaugh, although from his view, defending his honor in front of the country and his family, was justified in being forceful, even irate. I do think he crossed the line in terms of the partisan edge that he brought to his defense last Thursday, that a former Supreme Court Justice, John Paul Stevens, a Republican, has withdrawn his support for Kavanaugh based on that partisanship, that very sharp edge, I think is significant. Second, I think there are examples of a lack of candor where in questioning in front of the committee and in tension between that questioning and what's in the record, there's reason to be concerned about Judge Kavanaugh's candor. And then last, I think Dr. Ford brought forward credible allegations that were not corroborated because corroboration wasn't looked for. You can't find what you don't look for.
So kind of the remaining question is, how is this going to impact 2018? And that is still, you know, kind of up in the air. Democrats, you know, especially look pretty good. They have their chances are good at regaining majority in the House. But there's been some interesting polling, and I'm going to write a little bit, hopefully this weekend, about you know, what the Democrats have done to their election chances in 2018 based on their handling of the Kavanaugh confirmation. And I think, you know, personally, I think they stepped in it. I don't think they even realized how bad they stepped in it. Harvard poll came out, not a liberal institute or not a conservative institution by any stretch of the imagination, that showed 69% of Americans believe that Kavanaugh should be confirmed if, you know, there be no corroboration as far as the allegations made. 75% believe that Senator Dianne Feinstein should have immediately turned over the letter to the committee so they can investigate. Americans don't approve of her handling of that particular letter and how she's proceeded forward. So I think there's going to be some blowback. And then an NPR PBS NewsHour Morris poll shows some interesting things. NPR reports, just over a month away from the critical elections across the country, the wide Democratic enthusiasm advantage that has defined the 2018 campaign up to this point has disappeared. In July, there was a 10-point gap between the number of Democrats and Republicans saying the November elections were very important. Now that is down to 2 points, a statistical tie. Democrats' advantage on which party's candidate they're more likely to support has also been cut in half since last month. Democrats still retain a 6-point edge on that question, but it was 12 points after a Marist poll conducted in mid-September. So, and also some of my thoughts, it's kind of a gut feeling from what I've been seeing, and it's obviously anecdotal, but this provides at least some data to kind of back it up that, you know, Republicans are getting fired up, and I frankly have not seen so much unity among center-right voters as I've seen during this Kavanaugh hearing. It's widely known I was never Trump. I've been riled up about this. I'm not a fan of President Trump's, even though I do like some of his policies, and I've been quick to point out things that he's done well. But I'll also, I'm free to, I'll definitely criticize him as well. But I think this is how this has been handled and how his family's been treated and just it's just been a sham. And it's made me angry. There's very few things that have made me angry, but this is definitely one of them. And also just going back to Chris Coons' statement, saying that, talking about Kavanaugh's temperament, I'm like, and this is something I've seen various Democrats criticize, and actually the American Bar Association's reopening their evaluation of Brett Kavanaugh based on temperament because of his testimony that he gave. He was angry. I think how can you not be angry when you've been smeared in the national media, when you've been called a serial rapist, a gang rapist, a liar, evil? Not be mad about that. It's not like he was spouting off on the bench. He was directing his anger toward the people who were, throwing poo at him, basically. So that's just how a human responds. I think that criticism is over the top. And frankly, again, it's just another way to try to drag his reputation in the mud, to try to block his nomination, his confirmation, because nothing else seemed to be working. So anyway, I could go on and on about that, but it's time to turn to my interview with Jake Porter. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Jake Porter, Libertarian nominee for governor of Iowa.
So I'm with Jake Porter, who's the Libertarian nominee for governor of Iowa. Jake, a question I always ask everybody that's running for office, and I think I've asked you before, and you've been on my, when we had a radio program, why are you running for office?
Well, two reasons. One is the Libertarian Party of Iowa has major party status now. I want to continue that. If we get over 2% in this election, and it's looking like with the poll numbers that we're going to, we continue that major party status, and that allows us to run a lot more local candidates and be a major influence on Iowa politics going forward. Without that party status, we tend to get ignored. It makes it more difficult to run candidates or to nominate candidates, and we don't get to actually put people on the ballot until much later. So that's one of the reasons why. And the other reason I'm concerned about the direction of our state, I think there's a lot of things that aren't getting addressed, or the root causes of the problems aren't being addressed, like the budget, for example. Mm-hmm. One of the major issues I see with the budget is there's over 300 boards and agencies in the state of Iowa, many of which can be consolidated, eliminated, or just made more efficient. And that's something that never really gets addressed.
So what would be on the chopping block for you as far as boards are concerned?
Well, we can go through there. It's each one of them has, there's a lot of their promotion boards, for example. You got the, and they're not necessarily coming out of the general fund usually. They're usually either a tax on the producers or the tax on the consumers. Those are one thing, though, that can go away overnight. And if the producers want to have, a co-op, for example, that buys up advertising, they would be free to do that on their own. But they shouldn't have the state being a part of that. And that would lower costs to them, and a lot of them might decide they didn't want to be a part of that. There's also several things in like the education budget that have nothing to do with education. You can go through that list on and on and on. Several things can be cut. Many of the, I know, for example, the boards, you have all these human rights commissions many of which don't have a whole lot of participants right now. And it would make more sense to consolidate them all into one board. It would actually make them much more efficient, and they'd be able to help more people.
Okay, as far as the budget, I mean, one of the things I've been really concerned about is that state spending keeps on increasing, even under a Republican administration. How would you approach the budgeting process differently than Governor Reynolds or Governor Branstad before her?
Yeah, so under them, it grew $1 billion. The budget grew $1 billion, which is much more than inflation. What I would take a look at is going through, the governor does set a recommended budget every year, so we couldn't set the recommended budget for next year, but going into 2020, we'd be able to set that recommended budget. Go through there line by line, look at every department, every agency, every line of spending in there, determine what is necessary. Now, of course, the legislature has a part in this too. So once we submit our recommended budget, the legislature, they're going to send back their proposed budget, and we'll go through that process. Now, we won't get everything we want, but we can get a few things. And I think just going through and asking what is necessary, what is going to be our priorities. I might not necessarily agree with members of the legislature on what the priorities are, but we need to set some. That way we can, the spending doesn't balloon out of control, that we don't have these mid-year budget cuts like we've had in the past, that we, you know, have a better idea of what our state income is going to be every year, and that we're not taxing people to pay for wasteful government.
Okay, so going back to education, since education is one of the huge issues in this particular election, particular education spending, I mean, we're hearing from Democrats in particular saying, hey, you know, we're not fully funding schools. And then Kim Reynolds points to, hey, we are fully funding schools, and we've actually, school funding's increased over the last few years, which is true. But yet, you know, there are teachers who are complaining about, hey, pays, you know, it's something we're seeing nationally, is that teacher pay is becoming an issue. How would you address that in a Porter administration?
Well, a lot of times they look at the school funding. Well, a lot of the funding we give goes to administration, bureaucracy, implementing these national standards, standardized tests, things that really don't educate anyone, don't help anyone. In fact, many of them actually hurt. They hurt our education system. I propose going back to a more local control over education, letting the school boards make some of these decisions.
Okay, and, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, just getting kind of the state government out of the way and the federal government out of the way.
Right, well, that's part of the problem, because the federal government, through the Every Student Succeeds Act, some people say it provides states more flexibility, you know, but it still requires summative assessment that the state provides, and it also actually requires that assessment is then aligned to, you know, the state standards, which unfortunately there's language in the bill that essentially would say, you know, basically Common Core aligned. It's got to be focused on workforce development. How would you deal with those expectations of the federal government as governor?
Well, I think you got to start to push back a little bit. In the past, we've always, we'll just call it something different. We're still going to do what the federal government wants. And many times these strings that they start attaching to things aren't really worth all the cost of it anyway. These funds that they attach, that they put the string, they're not really worth all the cost that it costs the state to endure. So occasionally maybe we say, well, we're not going to accept your funding on that. That would be something we have to look at, you know, case by case, but it's certainly something we should consider doing. When they try to tell us how we're going to educate, their ways aren't working. I think we know a little bit more here in Iowa than they do in D.C. So maybe it's time we just tell them we're not going to follow these standards.
Okay. So, and they say, all right, we're going to withhold funding. I've yet to see the federal government actually follow through on that. But if they did, how would we respond?
Well, one of the great things about having the Iowa caucus is if they ever want to run for president, I don't think they'll try to do a stunt like that. We do have a little bit of power with some of that. And I don't think most of them want to say, well, we're going to cut funding to schools. I don't think they really want to play that game. They okay. might, but I don't think they're willing to.
Okay, so one thing I've noticed, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, we hear a lot about teacher pay, but yet it seems like there's a growing national trend anyway. I haven't actually seen this boil down to the state level, but I can't believe it's much different in Iowa. But we're essentially seeing more non-teaching staff in schools, that non-teaching staff actually outnumber teachers in schools, be it, I guess your janitors, be it counselors, be it psychologists, be it lunch lady, are schools basically, is it your opinion, or do you think that schools are maybe spending money in areas where they don't need to be as far as all this stuff that's going on outside of the classroom?
It seems like it. I hear a lot of complaints too about a lot of spending coming down to sports funding or whatever else that doesn't really educate anyone, doesn't really help anyone out.
Okay. Moving along, another issue we're hearing a lot about is with the Medicaid and Medicare and the state's privatization of that program. What would that look like in a Porter administration? How would you deal with that? And what's your view of the current state of Medicare?
I think it's been a disaster. We can disagree over these programs or what the programs do or the scope of the programs, but the fact is, at the end of the day, we still have them. Mm-hmm. A lot of these are federal government policies that the next governor, they're not going to change largely, but we have to manage this. I don't think the current system is good, and the reason is because I view it as a handout to three big corporations. Now they're down to two. At some point, if one more of them drops out, they'll have a complete monopoly over the state. When we see what that happens, if about 3 or 4 weeks ago, they raised their rates or their cost to the state 7.5% overnight. When that happens, that erodes about $100 million of the budget. Fortunately, we had a budget surplus this year, so it didn't cause major issues. But can you imagine what would have happened if that would have happened last year or the year before that? We would have been faced with major issues that we had to make last-minute cuts towards the end of the year or try to borrow what's left of the emergency fund. That would have been disastrous. So I don't think that has worked. And then I have a real problem also when these companies can, bribe or contribute large amounts of money to the people negotiating their contracts. And it's Democrats and Republicans. Don't let them try to tell you otherwise. I've seen some Democrats try to claim, Reynolds got campaign contributions from them. Well, that's true, but so did the leading Democrats.
Okay. So what would you continue with privatization, should you win the election?
I would revert it back to where it was before, and then we would take steps to look at coming up with something better. We'd involve all the stakeholders, members of the legislature. I would not act unilaterally to take that back over and privatize it. I think we should involve the people that are on these plans. People that are impacted. I went over to Passageway, the clubhouse, deals with mental health the other day, talked with them and how this has negatively impacted them, and they can actually save the state quite a bit of money. Now they're not getting reimbursed. It creates massive problems for them and ultimately a bigger drain on the state resources.
Great. So what are some other things that you would like? What would be some of your top priorities that we haven't discussed, should you be elected?
One of the big things that hasn't been addressed much this election is prison overcrowding. Right now our prisons are over capacity. In the next 7-8 years, they'll be over capacity, they'll be around 142% capacity. State doesn't have the resources to fund new prisons. I worry about what happens. Is the state going to start letting violent offenders out? That is a concern of mine. I would rather we stop punishing, nonviolent drug crimes. We treat them as a mental health issue. And we also look at expunging the records of people that have not harmed anyone, people that might have, had a youthful indiscretion 20, 30 years ago, that we expunge their records for that. That way it makes it possible for them to find work. They don't have, a lot of problems long term. It creates economic problems for them, doesn't help the state's economy out. And some of these things have clogged up the criminal justice system.
Okay. Want to look at tax cuts. Tax cuts are something that, at least the current tax relief plan that was just passed, Fred Hubble said that, you know, he would possibly peel back if revenue doesn't continue to meet, you know, his, what he says, his, the state's priorities, which under a Hubble administration, I shudder to think. Was the tax relief plan good? Did it go far enough? What would you pursue as governor if elected?
My issue with it, there's a few things. The biggest one is it doesn't actually cut spending. So there's no tax relief unless, revenues go up, then there's a little bit of relief.
Right.
And they haven't cut spending. It just kind of maneuvers around, oh, we're not going to exempt these online sales anymore. We're not going to exempt the blood plasma. It just kind of moves things around. So it's not really tax cuts. It's moving things on paper. And then, oh, we hope revenues go up and we can tell everyone we cut their taxes. I'd rather actually cut government spending and then cut taxes. Use of that in a kind of a responsible way. And I would also look at, quit picking winners and losers in the marketplace.
Okay.
Through things like corporate welfare, the research activities tax credit, there's large financially sound corporations in the state of Iowa that get actual welfare checks cut to them. They don't even pay taxes in the state, but they're getting welfare checks to conduct research, which help their bottom line. Which puts them at an unfair advantage over their competition or smaller businesses. I think the state should quit picking winners and losers in the marketplace. I didn't think that. I'm always amazed. I did not think that centrally planning an economy was a Republican value. I didn't think giving money to big corporations was something the Democrats liked either.
Right.
But they both do it.
Right. Yeah. Well, that seems to right. It seems to be easier than actually improving Iowa's tax environment, which I agree with you that let's make taxes low for everybody, but yeah, definitely cut spending. Back to tax cuts, they initially, there is some tax relief at the individual as well as corporate rate, not obviously the full extent, which I believe is set for I want to say 2022-2023 if they hit that revenue goal. Mm-hmm. I think it's total of like 8% growth over those years. So yeah, definitely didn't go far enough, in my opinion, but it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was nothing, but certainly I agree with you that they needed to address spending. Also wanted to talk to you about, Governor Reynolds, she's been endorsed by Susan B. Anthony List, and she's been a pro-life governor. She signed the fetal heartbeat abortion ban, which obviously is tied up in court right now. Why should somebody's pro-life vote for you?
I would cut the funding to Planned Parenthood.
Okay.
I see something really wrong with that, where they can collect state funding and they go out and they lobby and they give money to politicians, right?
Mm-hmm.
I see a problem with that. Now, if they want to collect funding, they can. No one's stopping anyone from donating to them. That's fine. Competing organizations people can also donate to. But I don't think they should collect state funding. And that goes for any abortion provider.
Okay. So also another thing that, I've been concerned about, unfortunately, I haven't seen, there were bills introduced in the state legislature last couple of years, but they've gone nowhere. And that's to address religious liberty protection in the light of, after the Obergefell decision in 2015, we've seen a numerous, high-profile cases nationally, even one in Iowa, where business owners are being penalized by the state because they don't want to participate in a particular, in this case, same-sex marriage, but you could actually apply this, or wedding, you could apply this to, a variety of different situations. What would you do as governor to protect religious liberty?
Well, and of course, not having a bill, it's in seeing one, it's difficult to say what that would look like. But I believe people should be free, for the most part, run their business as they see fit, so long as you're not harming anyone else. And you do have the right to decide, to pick and choose your customers. And if the marketplace doesn't like that, it'll put you out of business. I think that's more of a role for the market and not a role for the government. And so I support, you know, people's rights to protest, their right to believe whenever they want. There was a case over here in Council Bluffs a year or two ago that was the Day of Prayer. I don't know if you remember this one. And they applied for a permit to go out and pray outside the courthouse, and they didn't get it. Now, first of all, I don't think you'd have to apply for a permit to go out there and pray. You're not harming anyone. You're not obstructing anyone. Secondly, why does that hurt anyone? I don't think that hurts anyone at all. I think they should be free to do that. And I don't think the state should tell you. I think it's very dangerous when the state starts to tell you how you can believe or what you can believe.
Okay. So, you know, one thing we're seeing, and this will kind of spin into our conversation about the debate, but, you know, I'm hearing people, we've heard especially when I was, because I was never Trumper during the 2016 election, well, we really have a choice between two parties, Republican and Democrat. And Republicans would say, well, hey, a vote for a third party is really a vote for the other guy. And Democrats would, you know, say, hey, a vote for a third party is a vote for, you know, the Republican. How do you respond to that? I mean, how do we combat this two-party system?
Well, it is funny because there was one, I think it was a Facebook thread, they forwarded me. It was a Republican says, oh, you're going to cost Kim the election. Now, a couple lines down, Democrat, you're just costing Hubble the election. I said, which one is it? Who am I costing? It doesn't make any sense to me. And we can do analysis, and it turns out, you know, most of the people that are voting for me wouldn't normally vote. They're fed up with the system itself, and they're using it to send a message. It's saying, right, we're not going to put up with this anyway. And I find it odd, you know, even when we knew Branstad was going to, when we had Dr. Heber, a great candidate, there were people, oh, I just can't vote for her. He's going to let Jack, you know, no one thought Jack Hatch was going to win.
Right.
But there were people that still voted for Branstad because of that. I don't think it makes a whole lot of sense. And if we look at the role of, you know, what minor or third parties have done in the history of the United States, a lot of times they won without even winning a lot of elections. You look at the Socialist Party, they won. They got most of the planks of the New Deal were part of the Socialist Party platform. They did that not because they won a lot of elections, but they started making the margin of difference between the Democrats and Republicans to where the Democrats adopted their ideas. Prohibition Party did that. There's several examples. Or there's also the possibility that they could do like the Republicans did when they replaced the Whigs back in the 1800s.
Okay, so yeah, that's something definitely we saw that, or at least briefly, a resurgence in the Republican Party of embracing more libertarian perspective. Not that necessarily followed through on that, but we did see that. So, you know, were you surprised by the last Iowa poll that had you at with 7%? Was that kind of what you were expecting, or higher than you're expecting, lower than you're expecting?
We were predicting, I was predicting around 5 to 6% was where I thought it was. I see a lot of things going on that we didn't see before. We also had the Emerson poll come out about 2 weeks before that had someone else at 7%, and they didn't list me by name.
Right.
So
right.
We knew we were close. We've monitored the media mentions. We're getting, you know, media every week, just about every day now. We've got a lot more media coverage than we've ever received before. We're doing YouTube ads targeting younger voters across Iowa. We thought we were doing really well. We didn't think it was quite that high. We didn't originally think it would be quite that high as 7%. We were very happy to see that, though. And I think it shocked a lot of people in the media.
Okay. So you've been getting a little more attention as a result?
Yes. Everyone wants to talk about that. And the Democrats are quick to say, oh, no, the, you know, libertarians always pull higher than what they do. And so I looked up the statistics, and, you know, usually we've pulled about 0.5%, 1%, maybe a little bit more higher than what we did in the general election, the Iowa poll. So I said, I don't, they're trying to say, oh, you're below 2%. I don't think so.
Well, I don't recall an Iowa poll where you guys were actually included.
They had one with Dr. Heeb that had her at 3%.
Oh, they did. Okay.
They did. Yeah. And I think it was the Iowa poll with her. I know the Iowa poll had Dr. Cooper in 2010 that had him at around 2%. He finished around 1.3-1.4%.
And, you know, I think in a contested election like this, especially when you have an increase of no party voters. I mean, I myself left the Republican Party, registered as no party. So it didn't surprise me. And based on what I saw Des Moines Register, you know, report that, you know, definitely most of your poll is probably among that no party group. So definitely you seem to be making some inroads into that group, which is totally, you know, totally makes sense. So you've been excluded from all three debates. Make a case why you should be in the debates, and why are you targeting KCCI in particular?
Okay, so it's really interesting. I was originally invited to the Sioux City debate before they rescinded my invitation. I think that I should be in these debates because there's a lot of voters still undecided. You know, if you add up the undecided in the Iowa poll, the my voters, it comes out to, I think, 15%. Then you've got about 30% of both of Hubbell and Reynolds supporters that say they would be willing to vote for another candidate, potentially. They're not real strong. You add that up, and this race would be very interesting to see what would happen. But I think debates are a little bit more than that. It allows us to bring up issues that would otherwise be ignored. I don't think it's fair to the people of Iowa that KCCI is condescending and talks down to them and has decided who we're going to hear from. You know, they tried to claim, well, you don't have a chance to win. Jack Hatch didn't have a chance to win. Patty Judge didn't have a chance to beat Chuck Grassley. They still got to debate.
Right.
There's candidates in Utah that run for governor that get around 25% in a two-way race. They still get to debate. They still get to get their ideas out there. I don't think it's the job of the media to give in-kind contributions to campaigns. I don't think it's the job of the media to pick winners and losers or to tell Iowans how they're going to vote. KCCI disagrees. They think that's their job.
Okay. So basically KCCI responded to a letter from the Libertarian National Committee and said, you know, kind of more or less, stick it.
I would have thought they're getting such negative PR. It's been great PR for us. That's probably one of the reasons we're at 7%, and they continue to go. I would have thought they learned their lesson.
Yeah.
But I guess not.
All right. So just last minute pitch for our listeners. Why should they vote for you?
Well, if we keep voting Democrat and Republican, nothing is changing. Things get worse. The government always grows. The government always takes more of your liberties. The government always grows in response to how much they're taking in your taxes. They are going to take more. They're going to grow. They're going to take more of your hard-earned money. They're going to take more of your personal liberties every year unless you finally tell them no.
All right. Well, hey, Jake, thank you so much for talking with us. I appreciate it. Take care and best of luck to you.
And that concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please be sure to check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. Again, that's caffeinatedthoughts.com. CAFFEINATED, Caffeinated Thoughts. You can just Google Caffeinated Thoughts and it'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, be sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our emails. That way you don't miss a single article. Also, you can catch our podcast on Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, as well as SoundCloud and Spotify. So you can listen to our podcast on your favorite podcast app on your phone. Thank you so much for taking time to listen. This is Shane Vanderhart. Until next time, my friends, take care.